It's Thursday, May 30th, 2013, and you're listening to episode 299 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 48 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
This is Julia.
My name's Chad.
This is Sergeant Dan.
That's right. Joining us today, we have Sergeant Dan, U.S. Marine Corps.
Hoorah. You know, Dan, you sound so much better when you're not in the middle of a hurricane.
Thanks a lot.
I'm reading this book by Ken Height.
Yeah.
And Chad has a theory on it.
It's not a theory. I know I'm right.
Well, that's the thing is I'm backing this theory. I believe he's completely right. But Ken Height, we had him on the show. And if you recall during that show, one of the things we asked him about was his education, because he has like a master's degree in history and in international affairs or something like that. So he came out with this book called The Nazi Occult, and it's a book that is, it's a historical book. The only fictional part of it is it takes some of the more extreme claims of the Nazi Party and the Thule Society and all that at face value, as if all of it was true. But, you know, that aside, it is all based on things that were actually going on, you know, real names, dates, places, and events. Like I said, it just kind of accepts the claims without any sort of filter, but that's kind of the book's premise. And I've been enjoying it just because of the fact that I like World War II, and I've always found occultic things fascinating. And so this is about the whole, you know, spin of them searching for holy relics and the magical things they were into and whatever. And there's all this kind of crazy, you know, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction sort of stuff. But obviously Ken Height is involved in role-playing games. And in the back here, there's even a further reading section that has, among other things, references to role-playing games.
Yes.
And as you flip through the art, quite frankly, looks like adventure covers. We found
really
one
really good role-playing art
where they had three different
Nazi
archetypes.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's like they look like character classes. And so Chad has this theory, which I'm completely agreeing with.
I believe, now I could be wrong, I don't think I am, Ken Height wrote a book, a role-playing game about Nazi occultism, where you play Nazis and the occult. And he realized, probably rightfully so, that people get really pissed off if you publish a game where you play Nazis. And I think that instead of actually making a game, he made it a history book.
Yeah.
So the history book is great. And
that's what I think, too, is he was making a historically based RPG.
Yeah.
They did a little bit of market research and came to find out that Nazis are not real popular.
People really, really hate Nazis.
Wow.
Like a lot.
And so, it's a surprise, isn't it?
Anyway, it's a cool book, though.
Oh, it's an awesome book.
Yeah, it's a great book. All right, so our one announcement today, my ramblings about Ken Height's book aside, Sergeant, go ahead and take it away.
Because a lot of the East Coast booters had not been able to get out to Fear the Con. Several of them have never been to Fear the Con in St. Louis. We're, with the help of a friendly local game store in Raleigh called Game Theory, are sponsoring a mini con for the East Coast booters, held in Raleigh, North Carolina. I gave you the link, Dan, if you could put that in the show notes.
Yes, sir. We'll be in the show notes.
Sign up like you would for Fear the Con. Come on out. $10 a head to help cover the game store's costs, get some prize support, and just have a good time. The Game Theory store is a great community. Great games out there. War Machine and Hordes, role-playing games, the trading card games. It's a great place to come and hang out. And everybody's more than welcome to come. Let's get our game on August 10th.
Yeah, so August 10th, Raleigh, North Carolina. If you are in that area, be sure to head on over and join these guys. I'm going to try to make it. I don't know if I'll be able to or not, but there is at least a slim chance that I will be there. Also, if you are marking your calendars, Fear the Con 7, we are 99% sure on its dates. There's one thing left that we're trying to just kind of dot our I's and cross our T's on. But once that's done, this is set. It looks like it's going to be June 12th through 14th. So anyone who had conflicts in early May with graduations and such, you will not have that excuse in 2014. It will be in the middle of June instead of early May.
Churchill will still be running Traveler.
All six slots.
Yep. And Jenny will be running Everything is Dolphins, all six slots.
Oh my God, I love that game.
That sounded like a lot of fun. So next year, I'm going to try to get into it. I've played Churchill's Traveler now. Now I need to play Jenny's Dolphins.
I have two games thought out for Fear of the Con 7. One of them is a game I want to play. One of them is one I want to run. The one I want to run is, after watching Mikey run my own game for me several years in a row, I think I'm actually running a Skies of Glass game. And I want to set it away from kind of the wilderness, something a little bit more industrial, and kind of show that side of the setting. The game that I want to play in, I want Bob Ahrens to take Watership Down and do whatever it is he will do with that setting. And I want to play that. I don't even know where that's headed, and that's part of the majesty of it.
I smell another Mikey song coming on. Scooby Thulu is just so awesome.
See, I'm leaning towards, instead of doing Bard's Bard 3, doing Blood Moon Bards.
Oh, gosh, that'd be so amazing.
Playing Blood Moon Goblins in the Blood Moon Goblins setting where the entire party is bards.
I played in a game that John was running for some of his friends. Yeah, I played in it with Chad.
Yeah.
And I played the Goblin Bard, and they are not very good. This is going to be really interesting. They can't do anything.
Did you actually play Brat?
Yeah.
I got a lot of mileage out of Brat until John killed me on this retarded ass.
You knew it was going to happen.
I know it's a John game. Yeah, there's.
You can't complain.
He's like the sensei from Cobra Kai.
Yes, he is.
There shall be no mercy in this dojo.
Yes.
Anyway. All right.
Correct me if I'm wrong, because I heard this all second, third, fourth hand.
Yeah.
Didn't he even say that he was going to kind of give it to you? Like, he would let your character survive in a way, but you said, no, this is a John game. You got to be true to yourself.
That's 99% correct. It was nuanced a little bit differently. Sure. The death happened, and John did say, if it really bugs you, I won't kill your character. We'll just put him in a coma or something like that. But my thing was not so much that I wanted to be true to a John game. It was just more to me, it would have felt cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've ever had that. And this is, I don't know, maybe we should come back to this as a major show topic at some point. But have you ever had a game master give you something in a game and you don't want it because of the fact that it feels cheap? It feels fake. I've had that a few times where I've had characters get really messed up or even killed. And the game master's been like, well, we'll back that up. But it's like, at that point, it's like the character's just, I don't know, dirty now. It just doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel fair somehow, which is weird because I'm not big into game death. You know, I'm not big into player character death. But when it happens, I really hate having it rolled back. And he offered to roll back, but just something about it just felt really cheap and wrong. So I'm like, no, I can't do that.
I'm a whore. If it's not going the way I like, I'll gladly take a roll back so I can get the character I want and the story I want out of the character.
You know, and I should be that way. Everything else about me, you know, if I was to fill out a personality survey for the kind of gamer I am, everything else true about me would point to me being the same kind of person. But for some reason, when it actually occurs, it doesn't feel that way to me. It doesn't quite work that way. I don't know. Anyway, all right, Wayne, you had a topic for us, so go ahead and kick that one out there.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious for everyone else here. What has been your biggest struggle as a GM? What are your GM weaknesses?
You.
Your beautiful face.
And what have you done to get around that? So I'll start off with an example here. So for me, one of the things I've had the problem with is actually setting my foot down and saying, okay, we're gaming now, everyone shut up.
No. Oh, I just quit bothering.
No, so Wayne solved it.
I came up with a solution that works
totally
well for me.
I can't wait to hear this because we need this.
So we were playing a Dresden game.
Mm-hmm.
I went out. My wife has a skull that she got from Halloween a few years ago.
A foam skull.
That she has painted up to look like Bob the Skull.
Yeah, I love Bob.
From the TV show version. So I've brought this as a prop and I've made it known when the skull comes out, we start.
When the clown is down.
And
exactly.
We posted on Facebook and somebody said, the skull is down, people.
Yep. The moment I set the skull on the table, that is my signal to everyone. Because it's a lot easier for me to do that than say, hey, everyone, shut up. We're starting.
Yeah, you're too
I
nice
bring the
for
skull
that.
Out. And then Chad's usually the one that goes, oh, the skull's down.
That's
and
really then we smart. Start. Yeah. I really like that.
It sounds very silly because the character of the skull of Bob
Nothing to do with our game.
It has
at all
nothing. He's not in our game. It has nothing to do with our game. But we kind of, sort of, in a left-handed way, treat it as if Bob is there, and that if you're disrespecting Bob by not role playing.
If somebody is out of character and just talking about something else, someone will reach out and move the skull to be looking at them.
Oh, that's funny.
And it works really well. It was just one of those things where it's like, I have to do something because I'm not being forceful enough with the starting and getting everyone, you know, on the same page.
See, my problem is I have a significantly smaller voice than the rest of my gaming group. So if I'm ever GMing and I'm like, hey, shut up. Like, that's what it sounds like compared to, like, the boisterous of all my friends.
Get an air horn.
Well, being a Marine, I can pretty much command the table fairly easily.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, on our Friday game, I'm a player. And our poor GM has been through cancer 3 times. His voice is gone. And a lot of times I'm sitting there, and it's 9 people at the Game Storm on Friday Night Magic. So the door's loud. And a lot of times it's my big voice going, shut up!
Well, I have to say...
And I get the Magic players to quiet down, too.
Every year, I think almost every year at Fear the Con on Wing Night, I make a short speech, and everyone's talking, and I stand up on a chair, and sure enough, Sergeant Dan gives the roaring... Drill Sergeant, shut up, everybody, voice, and quiets everyone down. You know, appreciated.
That's something my brother didn't take away from the Marines. He's still pretty quiet.
Well, I was that way when I was a kid. Because for some reason I got the voice, if I'm talking a normal voice, most people ignore me, so I get louder. Mm. And Marines have taught me how to project, and so I can get somebody's attention.
Yeah.
So, Sergeant Dan, you don't have any problem gathering a group and getting them started. What have you struggled with?
Early on, because I'm a control freak, just the jarhead and the crowd in me was setting up the rails, and you will not come off the rails. You will. But that's kind of gone to a lack of preparedness, and I become very much a Chad GM.
Yes.
Even I run Shadowrun missions for the game store once
a
month.
Oh, shush.
You're going back to Chad school.
Shush.
Well, actually, what's great about it is that they are the most railroady adventures you'll ever see.
Uh-huh.
And I read it over. I know basically what the ending needs to be. And I know that the players are going to take it so far off the rails, because whoever writes these things must be a monkey just pounding on a typewriter.
Yes, Chris
Hussey.
And not
thinking about, well, there's nothing in here for the Matrix, and I got 4 hackers.
Yeah.
There's nothing in here for, you know, mages, and the mages is tearing everything up. I played in one mission where the start of the adventure was going to the Johnson to get paid. So right there, you know, it's going to hell in a handbasket. And we get caught by 6 knight-errant cops, cars. So there's 12 cops, 3 of us. What do you do? I put my hands up, put my hands behind the back, got on my knees, and it's like, okay, whatever you want to do. And the game master goes, yeah, you're supposed to have a firefight there. Yeah, it's like, who writes this shit? Yeah. But a lot of times, you know, just life getting in the way and trying to prepare an adventure sometimes gets in the way. A lot of times it's a quick outline, couple NPCs that I know I'm going to have, and okay, let's go.
One of the things that Dawn has really picked on me about is that I will have ideas all over the place, and I'll have whatever notebook is nearby, I'll grab and start writing them. So at one point, I had 6 different notebooks.
Yes.
And I had them kind of spread out in front of me as I'm trying to... I have a new notebook I bought to put it all in, but between the con and everything else, it took me a while to do that.
Well, you need to, like, do like Google Drive or something. I
try not to do electronics.
I like
when I'm
all
running.
Of his notebooks. It's very eclectic.
Because I'm down to 1 notebook now.
Because one will be like a spiral bound business notebook that he obviously ripped off from Scott Trade and that he was supposed to be taking meeting notes on, but he's writing his adventure.
Yeah.
And then another one is this little gold sort of fake book notebook. I mean, yeah. It looks like it's a hard bound leather gold inlay. Sort of notebook. But it's really tiny, and it's
one's
a
mini composition notebook.
Yeah.
And
I don't know. It's just, it seems like
it's nostalgic.
The nutty professor. I don't know how to explain it. It's like you have all these crazy notebooks and this crazy adventure, and I like it myself.
Dawn was right to make fun of me for it.
Yes.
And I've got it down to 1 notebook now.
1 notebook is good for the game, but I did like all your notebooks all over the place. And I did like how, you know, somebody would say, okay, well, I call up NPC so-and-so, and you're like, okay, I just need to look something up. No, not the notebook. Oh, crap, did I leave that notebook at home? Where's the notebook? Because he doesn't have, like, the NPC notebook. It isn't organized. So you'll have, like, adventure notes.
Well, it is now.
It is now.
But it wasn't.
Yes.
That was something that was a weak point that I fixed.
So in my games, when I game master, one of my weak points, and this is probably the biggest weak point I have that I really have no answer for is, for me, game mastering is about mood. My mood, my personal, I am either in the mood to game master, I have the mindset for game mastering, or not. And it's not really something I control. And I've had campaigns before where it's like I've showed up and I'm like, I really am just not feeling it tonight, guys. And we try and get through it and it's really bad. And I'm like, yeah, let's go bowling.
I have the same struggle. I don't know that I'd say it's my biggest struggle, but I do have the same struggle where it very much comes down to mood. The problem that that leads to with me is I think in some ways I like the idea of GMing more than I like actually GMing. And if I was to go purely off of mood, I don't think I would even run 1 in 10 games. And I look at it the same way, Chad, you and I some years back were talking about the creative arts. And we were talking specifically about writing. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems that people have with writing is they write when they're in the mood to write.
Writers don't write when the mood's distracted. Writers write.
Yeah, and that's the problem is you can't do it. You can't be beholden to those moods. You just have to do it. Because if you only write when you feel inspired, well, you'll end up with the first chapter of 20 novels and nothing finished, which is where most writers end up. I'd say the same thing about game mastering is you can't let your mood dictate that. You have to, on some level, see it as social obligation.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the problem that I've had that I'm kind of struggling with now is that's a bad road to go down, because we start to see it as social obligation and not so much a hobby. Now all of a sudden an element of the fun is gone. It's something you have to do, not something you want to do.
Well, it's interesting hearing this too, because for me, I look forward to it while I'm planning it. But when the time comes to actually GM, every time I sit down at the table, I'm thinking, I'm really not in the mood. And I'm about 2 seconds away from saying, let's do something else tonight. And then I start GMing.
And then you're fine.
Once I start, I'm fine. But that lead up, those, say, 5 minutes before the game, I am ready to cut and run every single time.
Something I've also found that helps with that is kick it to the players. I'll say to the players, look, I'm not feeling this. If you guys give me any resistance or even just give me blank stares, this is going to be over in 10 minutes. If you guys want a game tonight, I'm going to get you started. I'll give you a few intro sentences. I really need you guys to hop in character and carry this. And most of the time, the group rises to that, or at least one or two people. You'll get one or two really boisterous individuals who will step forward and kind of pick up to that.
I just have to get over myself each time and start. And once I start, my mood immediately changes.
Well, for me, it's not so much the mood is in, I don't feel like doing this. It's more of a matter, and I totally get what you guys are saying, because I've been there too. But for me, it's where my creative focus is. Like this last game that I tried to run as a sci-fi game, and it's completely flopped, and well, it should. My creative focus was not on creating and running this science fiction game. My creative focus was elsewhere. I think I was writing the rules for some unrelated role-playing game. And I was building my website and stuff. And it was like, I was feeling creative, but I just wasn't feeling creative for a game. And it was like the creative part of my mind was on a different gear than what it needed to be for the game, and the game suffered.
And that's part of the key, too, is if you're not in the storytelling mood, I mean, if you got nothing and you got basically a writer's block, you shouldn't be running the game.
Right. Yeah. The game will suffer. Everybody playing will suffer. You'll suffer. And what really the suffering is everyone wanting to make it work, which is it's great. You know, your friends are there and everyone wants to make it work, but you're just really grinding the gears and it's not happening. And eventually we all kind of said, this isn't working. And we kind of like, okay, that's fine. That's fine. Let's just walk away from this and then try something else.
For me, it's characterization. And I don't mean characterization in terms of the NPC specifically, though it could include that. But what I mean is that while my plots are typically really intricate and detailed, there's all kinds of stuff going on there, the settings and the NPCs, especially from campaign to campaign, start to get very samey. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I think I've been struggling with for some years now. I mean, they say that with most people, the biggest bulk of their creative ideas tend to come in their early to mid-20s. And thereafter, it tends to be a real struggle to create. I don't know how true this is, but I've heard this from multiple people. They say if you look at the great works of various artists and whatnot, at least the ideas and inspirations, even if the final works didn't come until later in their life, the ideas, inspirations, the concepts, these all popped up really during that stretch of life. And I found that really when I go to write a game, I'm pretty good at coming up with plots, but I struggle, I think, more and more as time goes on to come up with uniqueness to the places and to the people and to the any kind of life to the backdrop of the game. And what I have found that's helped is just stealing more liberally, looking at people I know, real history, characters in television shows, movies, books, paintings, whatever, and drawing from all these ideas to try and be like, okay, I know this is not samey because I didn't create this. Somebody else did. And therefore, it's going to have a different spin to it or a different feel to it. And that has helped me a lot. And it's something that I need to do more of.
I blatantly really do that.
And one of the things, too, is if you find a good, rich setting, regardless of where you get it from literature, from another role-playing game, whatever that setting is, delve into it, read up on it, and like you said, steal.
Yeah, in our current campaign, there are three characters that I blatantly stole from a book series that I know no one at the table has read, and they will never know that those characters came from the book series, because
fair enough.
I needed a character name, and I needed a personality, so I have one in the back of my mind.
This is no more Google's your friend. Google random personalities. If you have something like, let's say you're telling a story and you want a pirate, just Google famous pirates. Look at real historical or even major fictional pirates. And presuming it's not something that's so obvious, like, you know, Guy Steiner and like Keith Richards, it's maybe something a little bit more obscure than that. Then, you know, or you change it up enough to where people can't tell, then it's a great source of inspiration. But that's something, like I said, that I've been working on and need to continue working on, because it really is starting to feel like my games have a rut to them, even if not within the course of a game, certainly from one campaign to the next. All right. So, Dan, with that out of the way, let me kick this over to you, because you wanted to talk about Crunch. And if you were a captain, this would be much funnier.
Actually, that was one of my nicknames in grade school, was Captain Crunch.
How did this come about?
Did you eat a lot of Captain Crunch?
No, he was the famous hacker.
My seventh grade teacher just came up with it, and it stuck till about ninth grade.
He always walked around with a whistle.
Yep. Yep.
There's no story behind this. It just...
No, he just called me, started calling me Captain Crunch. And it just, up until about the end of my freshman year in high school, it stuck with me. And then it kind of drifted away. I outgrew it.
This is right up there with Chris Bean and Ernie. I don't know.
I know.
All right, figure. Well, Sergeant Crunch, set us up.
One of the things that I've noticed throughout my gaming career is the people talking about Crunch and how crunchy a rule system is, or even how crunchy a setting is. And a lot of people are downplaying it. A lot of people are espousing the virtues of Crunch. But really, what is it? It comes down to one thing. It's the mechanics and the framework. The mechanics of Crunch, the rule system, is your engine to help drive the story forward. And your setting Crunch is the frame. It's the framework that you work to lay a foundation to help tell the story.
Now, I want to talk about that for a minute, because the idea of mathematical crunch is fairly straightforward. And when most people pick up a game book and they say this is a crunchy game or this is not a crunchy game, at least in my experience, 99-something% of the time, what they're referring to is the mathematics of the book. How easy is it to create a character, to make a social check, to make a combat check, to figure out damage, heal, level up, whatever. That's what we're talking about when we talk about crunch. I'm curious how you apply this to setting, because crunch mathematically is typically very process-oriented. It's not just that there's a lot of stuff, it's that there are a lot of steps to doing anything. But with setting, it seems like you could have a lot of stuff, but I'm curious how would you draw that to say there's a lot of process to it?
Exalted, I think, is a very crunchy setting, although I still love it. It's a lot of reading. If you want to get into an Exalted setting and actually learn the entire setting, you literally have to read like 6 books. Like, that's what I would see as a crunchy setting.
Yeah, I would say the same thing for Battletech. A D&D game, you can pretty much jump in knowing very little about the world. Battletech, you seem to need to know a lot more about the setting.
Like the
actual
stuff. And
there's a lot going on in the setting as well. I would call Battletech a crunchy setting.
Well, believe it or not, I think Dresden is like that too. I mean, I'm not somebody who reads a lot of fantasy books because I tend towards the sci-fi. I've never read the Dresden books. I never watched the TV show. And then when we first started playing, there's certain rules to the game. And I don't mean if you want to hit this guy, you need to roll this for this to get this number. I mean, how do vampires work? You know, do they show up in mirrors or do they not show up in mirrors? How do werewolves work? Do they lose control? Can they control how they've done, you know, yada, yada, yada.
And put it that way, I can see the same thing certainly with Battletech, because in Battletech, let's say you're playing a mercenary. Well, you have to know things like, let's say you're playing in kind of the early 3050s. You have to understand what the relationship is between Galatea, the mercenary star, and Outreach. Yeah. You have to understand what it means to be a mercenary, what it means to be bonded, what the Ares Convention states.
If someone blows up a jump ship, you have to know why that's
a problem.
Relevant, why that's a big deal.
Why there are certain things you can and can't do on the battlefield. Why you can't step on an enemy pilot intentionally.
No matter how funny it is.
Oh, that's not funny.
But
no, it's pretty funny. Yeah, it is.
What if he squeaks when you...
But you know, I guess
what if it's a mime?
Put that way, though, the setting does go beyond having just a lot of stuff. Like, Forgotten Realms, I think, is a lot of stuff, but it's all fairly navigable. Whereas within Battletech, let's say even if there's only the same amount of stuff, maybe even less stuff. I don't know. I've never put the two side by side in those kind of comparison. But let's say for a moment, even if there is less stuff, the things are interrelated in such a way that you have to understand those relationships to really properly play the game.
It takes more to get the context of the game.
And I think Chad's right. The same thing's true with Dresden, because you have this rule about how, for example, the Fey realm can and cannot interact with the regular realm.
Yeah.
And what different kinds of vampires are and aren't allowed to do.
A wizard cannot kill you with a spell. Otherwise, he'll be hunted down and killed. But if he takes out a sword and cuts your head off, that's cool, man. You know, whatever. You got to do what you got to do. But if you use magic, oh, no. That's a line too far.
Yeah, I think that Dresden brings in, especially within its mechanics, new type of crunch. And the crunch is not in the math. It's in the language.
Mm-hmm.
You literally need at least a full session to create a character in Dresden. And it's not because you're sitting there adding, subtracting, multiplying, dividing numbers. It's the fact you got to sit there and come up with the setting aspects. You got to come up with your character's backstory and figure out aspects. And you got to word these aspects just right in order to have the best bang for your buck. Otherwise, your character's useless.
And to give the game master something to work with. Yeah, otherwise, it gets boring.
I know that was a shell shock for a lot of players. For us, typically, we would spend a session creating characters anyway.
Yeah, we love our group of friends loved it.
But I know not every group does that, and it was a real shell shock for some people. Like, I know Chris was surprised, and Johan was surprised when we made the characters for the Stone Keep game a while ago, Dan, because they weren't used to spending a whole session just creating a character. That was just normal to us. I didn't know everybody didn't do that.
That's been normal for me as long as I've been gaming. I don't think in any of my different gaming groups, and I've been in a ton of gaming groups for over 20 years now, and I don't think I have ever been in a gaming group yet where character creation was not a dedicated session.
And it's not the mechanic aspect of it generally either. It's the story and the backstory and how everyone fits together.
Well, some of it is the mechanics, but making a Star Trek character in the fastest Star Trek game, that takes several hours to do.
Harmaster is the same way. It's a lot of number crunching to get skills and then to try and get your armor and equipment that takes at least one game session.
I may be odd in that I find that fun. I actually really enjoy rolling through to create the characters. Like last year at Fear the Con, Church ran Traveler, and all we did was character creation, and that was a lot of fun, just rolling dice to create a character.
Did you?
That was literally all you did?
Yeah, we spent all 4 hours just making the characters, and then this year he ran a game with those characters.
That sounds awful.
Oh, it was
sorry.
Fun.
That is terrible.
No,
because you're telling the story. You're telling the story of the character.
Traveler character creation is fun.
Yeah.
It is absolutely fun.
You're developing the story of the character over time.
Chad is so mad over here.
My character wanted to be a pirate.
Get over it.
He rolled badly and failed being a pirate, so he became a nomad. Then he joined the army, and then finally he got the skills he needed to become a pirate.
I travel halfway across the U.S. I spend money on airfare, hotel, and con tickets. I can only be in 6 games. One of the games is nothing but character creation for 4 hours.
But it's building a story as part of the character creation.
Absolutely.
That's wonderful.
Ask anybody that was there for that session.
I'm sure. I'm not saying you guys didn't have fun. I'm not saying that. I'm saying something else entirely.
He's sitting over here with his arms crossed and all pissed pants.
I'm just pissing my pants over here.
Boo freaking
wow. Hey, if that's what gets you through the night, I don't judge much.
Seriously cracking me up because your arms are literally crossed like a mad little boy in a corner.
God, that sounds oppressive. Sorry. I mean, and I get taking all night to make a character.
Yeah.
You know,
you just don't want to do it at a con.
At a con, no. That's not.
I'm with Chad. I don't think I've ever played a con game yet where I've asked people to create their characters. The most I've ever done is maybe hand them sheets and say, okay, I'm leaving this kind of open to interpretation. Yeah. I want you to give the character your own spin. Maybe there's some details I haven't hammered out. But I don't think I've ever just handed somebody a blank character sheet.
I hear you. Some systems, Savage World, you can bash out a character real quick, mechanically speaking.
If you're familiar with it, if you got anyone that's new to the system, then
Dread.
Quags is the same way. I mean, it can get character sheet. I mean, that quick, slip of a finger, you got a character.
And then you get candy. And
I know, yum yum.
Yes.
You know, and that's part of what Crunch enables people to do, or the lack of it. I drove to St. Louis for the past 3 cons. It is literally a 900-mile trip by vehicle. I could do it in a moped, but it is not the most economical way to do it.
Actually, it'd be highly economical.
Well, considering I got to bring clothes, game equipment, and everything else on my back, it's
so medically economical.
Well, not to mention, I can't take that moped on the freeway. I got to really pick and choose my route.
What kind of moped do you have?
Is it a little Vespa?
I don't have one. Oh, God,
I can see
no.
you in like a...
The drunk mobile, I do not have one. But part of what Crunch enables people to do, both in game mechanics and in setting, is allow for a longer campaign. Quags is a great system. Mikey used it to great effect in the Skies of Glass game and in his Little Bashtung game. But it was one session. Quags is great for that. But if you're looking to get anything longer than a one shot or 2 or 3 sessions, you're going to need something with a little more substantial crunch to it in order to see a character development. There's got to be mechanical change to the character that's readily seen. Otherwise, it feels your character is stagnant.
Now, hold up a sec. I'd like to hear that one defended a little bit. Because I think certainly a crunchier game does tend to symptomatically create a longer campaign because of the fact that it takes longer to do things. An example would be Battletech. If we do a Battletech map combat, that's probably going to take most of the game session to do because of the fact that if you do a Battletech map combat, depending on what you got going on, it's going to take on the low end. I mean, this is like a super weird fast battle, 2 hours. On the high end, you're talking probably like 4 to 6 hours to get that combat done. Obviously, that's going to create a much longer game than somebody's got an abbreviated combat system where a few die rolls and you've bashed it out and the whole thing's over. But I don't know if I would go so far as to say that if you've got a light system or setting, that therefore the campaign must automatically be short because of the fact there's no sense of forward motion, because I don't know that forward motion has to come from the rules.
Yeah, and not all players need that character sheet to change. Like Chad, I know for character development, he could care less what's on the sheet. Mm-hmm. That's what's going on in game and in the character's head.
So I'm curious to hear you explain what you mean by that or to kind of defend that idea. At first pass, I'm not sure I'm prepared to sign off on this.
With a lighter system, the mechanics are not there to watch a character develop on the paper. And for most people, Chad is probably an exception to the rule. Where
no. I'm a total conformist.
You can see the development of the character within the story. And a lot of people, either through like the aspects, the changing of the aspects in Dresden Files, the changing of certain aspects within like Burning Wheel, watching this character within the mechanical system change, and you look forward on how it's going to change, how can I get this character to change mechanically within the rule system, also within the story of the setting, you know, within the framework of the history of the setting that's provided, in order to see this go through.
I think about, like, if I compare myself to Pat, because that's really easy because he's not here and I might be able to make fun of him. I think of myself compared to Pat. It's like you said, Dan, for me, the progress of the story is the progress. How the character changes and develops and sees the world and sees things and acts and reacts and how he changes to those things, those beats of the story, and how the story itself moves forward. To me, that's the progression. That's what I'm there for. That's what I like, that evolution of the story. Pat, not to say he doesn't like that, he does like that. I mean, he's there for the game and the story as well. But Pat, for him, the progress is numbers on the sheet. It's the mechanics. He wants to see his character sheet, whatever that represents. 99% of the games out there, your character sheet represents, generally speaking, combat. There's other games where it might not. And if we were playing a farming game and all your stuff represented farming and he was playing a farmer, his progress would be becoming a mechanically better farmer. But that's what he likes.
I kind of split the difference some here in that I want my character sheet to be changing frequently. The numbers don't have
variety.
Yeah, the numbers don't have to be going up.
Variety's good.
But I want my character's progression and change in personality or thoughts. I want ways to represent that on paper. See, and that doesn't have to be a constant climb. Has to be a reevaluation and a change.
You don't need numbers going up. You want additional / different buttons to press.
Yeah, that's part of it.
Pat, I think, wants numbers going up. No, that's an absolutely valid way of playing. Very traditional, very good way of.
I don't know. I take it as a cue. So, like, yeah, my numbers are growing up on my paper, but then I also grow my character at the same time, both within the story and whatever they're learning to do. And Exalted does it very well. And I'm talking about Exalted a lot because we're in the middle of a campaign. But whenever you take a skill or you learn a skill, if they don't let you learn things quickly unless it's part of your cast mark, which I'm not going to get into it. But you actually work into the story how you train for this particular thing. And like you have to wait so many months before you can take another skill in game. Months before you take another skill in it. And I think that that is the reason why I like that, is because it's a good mixture of the two. You know, your numbers are going up, but your character's growing as well.
Bringing us back to crunch, one of the things that I like more in a crunchy system is that the character sheet is very important to me, that it represents the character that I'm trying to play. Some people, the character sheet doesn't matter to them. Some it matters for numbers. For me, I want to be able to make the character that I'm playing on that sheet. And I find I have an easier time doing that in a more crunchy system. If I have more options to tweak, more numbers to throw in, I can better represent the character than a few, just one or two numbers or a rules light system. I do tend to prefer rules light systems, but a nice crunchy system, I can make the character in my mind a little bit better.
Something else that I think we kind of need to look at here is the average podcast maker and consumer within role-playing games is not a whole lot like the average role player in certain regards. Let me explain what I mean by that.
We're better. We have better taste. We smell better.
We're cooler.
Well, we're certainly different.
In a better way.
I was having a conversation with Ryan Dancy a while back. Obviously, part of his history, one of the things that he's known for within the gaming industry, is being one of the few people to really do a lot of detailed market research on what the role-playing industry looks like. There's not a whole lot of good data on podcast creators or role-playing podcast consumers. But I did take some of the data that was available, admitting that it was flawed as it was, and showed it to him. And I was just kind of curious, you know, what did he think of it? And one of the things that he pretty promptly pointed out is that the consumption of the average podcast creator or consumer, okay? So anyone that's hearing my voice right now, in all probability, your consumption habits are not like that of the average role player. For example, Burning Wheel, Savage Worlds, and Fate are wildly overrepresented. If you look at the podcasting audience hearing my voice right now and the percentage of all of us that play those three titles, it is a hell of a lot higher than it is across the vast majority of the role-playing consumers in the US or Europe, yeah, Australia or whatever. And where most of those people falls in fairly traditional games, mostly D20 type stuff, so D&D, Pathfinder, whatever, and most of them are inclined toward a mechanical progression within a game. And so we can sit around and say, you know what, we don't need mechanics to tell a story. And I believe that is absolutely true. And I believe that as someone who started off very heavily relying on Crunch to tell my stories, when I first met Paul's role-playing group, I was introduced to this idea of deeper characters and deeper story that didn't lean so heavily on math. You know, I still remember this exchange he and I had where I asked him at one point, some enemies were shooting at us. And I said, what are they firing at us? Because I was trying to get a sense of their tech level. And his response was special effect number 4. And there was that bit of kind of shift in my thinking to see another way of telling stories. And I think that that's something that gamers as a whole could benefit from. But I think we have to admit, while we have this conversation, that we, and we here, I'm not talking the hosts, I mean the people listening at home as well, generally speaking, we are atypical in this regard.
Yep.
The average role player is going to be somebody more like Pat or whatever who wants to see those numbers go up as they accomplish things. They're not going to be somebody like Chad, or if I hand him a bucket with 3 turnips in it, that's too much math and character sheet.
Whoa. Whoa.
Yeah. 3?
In the course of the last year.
You can't count that high.
No. Can at least have a turnip, a carrot, and an onion?
And Chad, I know what you'll do if I give you a bucket.
What?
Oh. You'll show me a bucket.
That's right.
You know, in the course of the last year, I have met 5 people through Facebook or work that all turned out to be role players that I didn't know of. And as it turns out of the 5, there were 3 games that were played. Anyone care to guess what those 3 games?
I wasn't even listening.
White Wolf's, I'm going to guess White Wolf's one of them.
Yeah, yes. So
D&D or Pathfinder has to be one of them, if not the other 2 of them.
Okay. Shadowrun?
You got me on the 3rd.
Shadowrun was the 3rd.
Okay, Shadowrun.
Those were the 3 that out of the batch of the 5 continued to come up. D&D, Vampire, and Shadowrun.
Yeah.
And actually, out of the 5, only one of them was just D&D. Most of them named all 3 games, and they had never played anything else.
That does not entirely surprise me.
No.
I'm a little surprised Shadowrun came up that high.
Yeah.
I was too.
I'm not surprised by the other 2. Because D&D / Pathfinder and Vampire, well, the World of Darkness as a whole, I shouldn't just say Vampire. Those 3 titles account for the vast, vast majority of game sessions that will occur in a week anywhere around the globe. It's going to be those 3 titles, D&D, Pathfinder, World of Darkness. Almost in that order. Pathfinder is now obviously surpassed D&D, but so Pathfinder, D&D. And then I believe World of Darkness is even a pretty far, well, how depending on how you look at it, 2nd/3rd to the Pathfinder D&D crowd.
And the interesting thing was most of the people saying D&D were playing 2nd edition. They had never gone past 2nd edition. That was interesting.
You know, that doesn't surprise me as much as it probably should.
2nd edition, is that Ben Barr's Liftgates?
Yes, that was the last one that had Ben Barr's Liftgates. That was
they've actually
the
reprinted
one,
it, too. I've seen it in stores recently.
Yeah, well, that was also the edition where they were really trying to keep the game profitable by turning out more and more stuff.
Mm.
And when you look at somebody who's got 6 walls of role-playing books,
it's all D&D.
Probably 90% of it is 2nd edition D&D. There are a lot of people that are sitting on a lot of legacy products from that era that still play it. Once again, the people that are consuming podcasts, we're not typical. You know, we don't really play the same types of games or play them in the same way that the average role player does. And so while I wanted to give the sergeant here a little bit of trouble over his comment that a crunchier game means a longer game, because I don't think that has to be the case, and I don't think that always is the case, I certainly think there is pretty good evidence that what he's saying does line up pretty damn well with the way reality works.
Yeah, in all fairness, I've never heard anyone say that they've run a 20-year Dread game. Dread hasn't been around for 20 years, but
on the other hand, we've had an Inspector's game with the same characters going on for at least 2 years now.
But it hasn't been nonstop.
And that's also not the full rules of Inspector's.
My question is, how many sessions have you played? And that's the real mark. That's the real diametric that you want to use, is the number of sessions. You could play a game for 2 years, but if you're only playing every other month, you know, that's 12 sessions.
What if you have a group that only plays once a month?
That's the thing. You know, it's 12 sessions, and there are some games that can handle that 12 sessions. There are some games that can't handle it.
Yeah. Well, you and know, then on the other hand, too, I know Pat, who, again, likes numbers going up. Not to say he doesn't like story, loves character development, wonderful role player who really gets into character, into the story. But he does love numbers going up. He is part of a D&D game that's been going on for like 15 years. They get together like once a year. That's a high crunch game.
But that's not how it started. It started as a weekly game or whatever. I mean, it started as a regular game. It's just they have kept it going all these
and
years.
And that's my question is, and how many like sessions?
Level 35 or something like that.
Oh,
I mean,
gosh.
I don't know. I mean, I know they're way up there. I believe it is an epic level campaign, if I'm not mistaken. And if I recall correctly, it is a game where they started at relatively low level. If Pat was here, I'd have him tell a story himself, and then he's probably start carrying on about pornography or something.
I think we'd
at least get partway through it.
I mean, I hear what you guys are saying, and I agree with it, but I think that that has more to do with tradition than any actual...
Yo, absolutely. You know, absolutely. I agree. Yeah. I completely agree. I really do believe that you could have a story-based, lighter, less crunchy game that carries on for a long time. I certainly think crunch... I guess makes it a little easier to carry on the long games because of the fact that your goals can become very quickly tied up in numbers that it takes a while to accumulate.
I would almost put the counter argument, but I think history proves me wrong, but I would put the counter argument up that crunch can actually bog you down because you start out at level 1 and you go through this hero's journey and you get to level 5, 6, 7, 8 and you're like these big strong heroes, and then you get to level 10 and then you're kind of like this Superman. You get to level 15 and then you're like these epic Superman. You get to level 20, 30, suddenly you're like this godlike being, and then where do you go from there?
That's with the typical D&D system. But if you get into things like Hero System or Harnmaster, where you don't have the leveling, you're just spending XP on new skills, trying to beef up your current powers, what have you. You could have those long systems, but a more gradual progression. And you're not necessarily Superman, but you can still see a progression in the character mechanically.
I think I'm going to just stew on this episode because it seems like we've covered a lot of things that I think are like subject headers for additional shows.
Yeah. I would be curious to see what people's comments are on each of these different topics.
Well, that may be part of
what we can break out from
some
these.
New other. Yeah. Some
well, and see what people
focused.
Latch onto what in this episode gets the commentary, so we know where the interest lies.
And then we can make new episodes where we totally rip off other people's commentary and we call it
our
content.
Own. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So, Dan, I want to thank you for joining us. Once again,
don't
forget to check the show notes. Once again, August 10th, Game Theory, Raleigh, North Carolina. Be sure to check the show notes for that. As for the rest of you guys, have a great week and great games, and we will catch you next time.
And Sergeant Dan, can you close us out with an oorah?
Oorah!
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.